Hello, you're listening to The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. Episode 4, Setting the Stage. Здравствуйте, товарищи. Hello, comrades, and welcome back. This episode will be the final of our introduction episodes. We've learned the basics of the guiding theoretical principles of the Soviet Union at its inception, Marxism and Leninism, and a brief introduction to the main cast of characters for 1917. Today, we are pre-partying with a crash course in the conditions that made the February Revolution of 1917 so very possible. We will be covering roughly 50 years of history, both domestic and international, prior to the revolution, since it is true what they say, nothing happens in a vacuum. There are 8 topics we're going to discuss. The emancipation of the serfs in 1861, the rapid development of capitalism in Russia at the end of the 19th and start of the 20th centuries, the tragedy of the Paris Commune and the lessons to be learned for future generations of revolutionaries, the Khodinskaya tragedy of 1896, the Russo-Japanese War and the Revolution of 1905, those two kind of happened at the same time, the impact of World War I on specifically Russian society, and just because I know a lot of people would be disappointed if I skipped over him completely, we will wave at Rasputin as we pass by on our way to the revolutions that await. Rasputin doesn't actually have a damn thing to do with the Soviet Union. But not mentioning him when discussing the Russian Revolution is like going to Moscow to see the sights and skipping over the park at Tsaritsyna. It's not in the center of the city, it's actually quite out of the way, and there's plenty else to see. But it's usually included in any list of the top places to see in the city, so if you've made the trip, you might as well check it out. Of course, before we get into it, I need to give the disclaimer I've given in every episode so far, that these are general outlines with a lot of details left out. Obviously, there's no way I can cover 50 years of history in great detail in the time allotted to us today. There's always more to say about each of these events, just not necessarily for our story. But I'm excited to say that since our story is starting after this, I'll be dispensing with that disclaimer soon enough. Tsar Alexander Nikolaevich Romanov, known as Alexander II, signed the Manifesto on the Abolition of Serfdom on the 19th of February, 1861. And it was about time, too. Serfdom had long been a burden on the Russian Empire and its economy. But the reason it took so long to actually do anything about it was that no one could figure out how to free the serfs in a safe and controlled manner. The issue with serfdom was twofold. One, it was embarrassing for the educated nobility when they talked to their counterparts across Europe that human bondage was still a thing back home. Nearly everyone agreed the abolition of serfdom was a moral imperative. And two, feudal serfdom was proving a less and less efficient way to organize agrarian production in the modern world. Not to mention that the quashing of ever more frequent peasant and serf uprisings just to maintain order was draining resources from the state. Thus, on the eve of emancipation, the overwhelming consensus in society was that serfdom simply had to end. Even the landlords who owned the serfs knew this change was coming. But Alexander did not just compose and sign a manifesto in one day. There was a lot of apprehension about how the serfs would act when they were emancipated. Would they riot and try to overthrow the landed aristocracy? Would they simply refuse to work if they were not legally bound to the land anymore? And what about the landowners? A large portion of their wealth was tied up in their serfs. Not compensating them was unthinkable, not least because that would be inviting the nobility to revolt and possibly overthrow the Tsar. In other words, the question of the serfs was the Gordian knot that was now plaguing the empire, and it fell to Alexander to untie it. Of course, it was a process to get from point A, knowing the change was needed, to point B, having the change actually take place. Once the decision was made to do the thing, the first step was taken in 1858, when the landed gentry of Russia started work in committees across the empire to propose policies for how to abolish serfdom. Of course, they advocated for their own interest above all else. Funnily enough, no serfs or peasants were asked to provide their input about what should be done with them. The plan that was eventually worked out did officially end human bondage in Russia, but it both failed to address the economic difficulties faced by the empire and created new ones. Farming serfs were given the land they had been tilling for themselves, but not necessarily the best land, and often it was less total land than anticipated. Domestic serfs were not given any land at all, and landowners were entitled to significant monetary compensation for the loss of both their serfs and land. To make sure the landlords got theirs first, the government determined what the overall compensation would be, paid a huge portion of it to the landlords up front, and then taxed the serfs to recoup the funds. On top of the taxes, the serfs were required to continue working for or paying their former owners to provide the rest of the compensation in so-called redemption payments scheduled over the course of the next 49 years. The redemption payments were abolished in 1905, a whole 5 years ahead of schedule, but by that time, the freed serfs had already paid 1.5 billion rubles on what had been calculated as less than 1 billion rubles of land and labor that had been taken from the landlords. Not to mention, there's something perverse about making people whose surplus value has been extracted against their will for over 200 years have to pay their previous owners for the privilege of being granted freedom. But I guess that's neither here nor there. Serfs didn't even own the land as individuals. Most of it was grouped together in communes called obshchiny or miry. These communes did provide protection and security for the recently freed serfs against the dangers of attempting to make it on their own. Many, including the author Lev Tolstoy, saw the Russian peasant and the commune as the moral backbone of the Russian national identity. However, they made it more difficult to modernize agricultural production. This was because there was nothing really connecting the individual communes, which were largely left to their own devices. So the communes were like islands. Each one was self-contained and dedicated to providing for their communities, but they were also limited by the resources they had on hand. Ultimately, the abolition of serfdom in Russia was necessary and the morally right thing to do, and so Alexander II deserves credit for doing it. He's not called the Tsar Liberator for nothing. However, between the inadequate amount of land given to the peasants, the redemption payments and taxes required of them, and the lack of follow-up to modernize agricultural production, it did not actually solve the problems it was designed to. In fact, it created a new problem in the form of peasants who were finding themselves in increasingly dire straits. Suddenly, and for the first time, tens of millions of people were no longer legally bound to the land, which created an enormous pool of untapped labor in the form of hungry people, desperate for any way to provide for themselves. This leads us quite nicely into the next topic, the development of capitalism in Russia. For anyone interested in a political economy resource on the topic, I recommend Lenin's Development of Capitalism in Russia, which he wrote in 1899 at just 28 years old. Unfortunately, we don't have time today for a deep dive into that work, so we're just going to discuss the process of rapid industrialization in Russia in broad terms. Starting in the 1890s, Sergei Vita, a particularly competent Tsarist minister, recognized that the empire's ailing economy needed to industrialize quickly to enter the 20th century in the strongest position possible. But there was a problem. Russia's domestic bourgeoisie was too weak and small at the time to do this on its own. So Vita embarked on a path of state-directed industrialization and capitalist development. He funded his project through high tariffs, heavy taxes on the peasantry, yes, more taxes, and attracting foreign investment. Vita focused on development of the rail system, which had been regarded by the Tsarist regime for decades as a double-edged sword. Rail was a necessary mode of modern communication, but the Tsars had long feared it would also facilitate the movement of the people, which would lead to a loss of control over them. But Vita knew that the project had been pushed off as long as possible, and the Empire needed a developed and functioning railway system. Lines, including the Trans-Siberian Railway, were built all over the country, and the staples of heavy industry began to take off. Extractive industries such as coal, precious metals, oil, and timber, and heavy industries such as steel production and textiles. In the final decades of the 19th century, the number of industrial workers across Russia nearly tripled compared to the middle of the century, and most of these new workers of the proletariat were drawn from the ranks of the starving and desperate peasantry. For the first time in Russian history, the urban proletariat was emerging as a distinct class. Of course, as has happened in all places where industrial capitalism takes off, working and living conditions were inhumane. The factories were cramped, the barracks were cramped, there was no sanitation system to speak of, the food was not only terrible, it was almost inedible, disease ran rampant, and the workdays were long and dangerous, with shifts averaging over 11 hours a day. As a result of all this, the peasants-turned-workers were growing more and more restless. Cities like St. Petersburg, the capital, and Moscow, the unofficial second capital, saw massive expansion of their urban proletariat, and the 1910s saw factories that employed thousands, even tens of thousands, of workers. And remember what Marx said, industrial production concentrates the workers in one physical space, teaches them that they have common interests, and primes them to act together in pursuit of those interests. The Russian proletariat is the textbook example of this. They were highly adversarial, with strikes a regular occurrence through the 1890s up to the February Revolution. In some years, the number of strikes ebbed, and in some years it flowed, but overall, the industrialization of the Russian Empire was not, shall we say, a peaceful and tidy process. It was, instead, rife with open class conflict every step of the way. We're now going to take a step back in time for a moment and shift our focus to an event that occurred in 1871 in France, Paris to be exact. This event had absolutely nothing to do with Russia, and in fact, Vladimir Lenin was only a month old by the time everything was over. But the lessons to be learned from the Paris Commune in the spring of 1871 were stark, and they were lessons little newborn Lenin and his Bolshevik comrades would take to heart when it was their turn to take a crack at the global socialist project. Lenin, in fact, wrote an entire chapter in State and Revolution titled The Experience of the Paris Commune of 1871, in which he defends and adds to Marx's own analysis of the event in the German's work, The Civil War in France. I was going to include this section in the episode on Leninism, but decided to put it off until now to keep that episode from being any longer and theory denser than was absolutely necessary. And I figured the story of the Commune would fit better in a broad overview of the history leading up to our narrative anyway. In the episode on Leninism, I did talk about Lenin's insistence on vigilance against the bourgeois counter-revolution. But what I didn't mention is that he came to that conclusion mostly based on his and Marx's analysis of the Paris Commune. Because at the time, 1917, the Commune was the example of an attempt to build a worker state to replace a capitalist bourgeois one. It was the only one in history, and so socialists across Europe had spilled much ink in arguing about what the Commune meant to their movements and ideologies. But at this point, I'm sure some of you are wondering just what the Paris Commune was. It is an often skipped part of European and world history, as much because it was a short-lived experiment that didn't have any lasting immediate effects on anything, as because, well, if your goal is to educate a population to be workers, it's maybe not a great idea to mention the fact that workers occasionally can challenge their ruling class. So to make sure we're all on the same page, I'm going to tell the story of the Paris Commune in about 5 minutes. Once again, we will be skipping the details, but if anyone is interested in them, I can recommend two sources besides the aforementioned work by Marx himself. The first is Season 8 of the podcast Revolutions, which covers the events of the Paris Commune in 8 bite-sized episodes. And the second is the book Massacre, The Life and Death of the Paris Commune by John Merriman. The podcast provides all the necessary historical context and is great if you just want to know what happened. As for the book, it goes into detail about what the Commune's goals and aspirations were. But in my opinion, the real strength of the book is just how much humanity it portrays when recounting the Commune's lofty goals and tragic end. Spoiler alert. Sorry, but come on, the title already gave it away. Okay, 5 minutes. Ready, set, go. The Commune officially lasted from the 18th of March to the 28th of May, 1871. It arose after the disastrous defeat and dissolution of the Second French Empire at the end of the Franco-Prussian War. During that war, Paris had been under a brutal siege for months, with many of the working poor freezing, starving, and dying. While the National Army had been fighting the war, the National Guard, that famous revolutionary body of the people that had first appeared in the Great French Revolution 80 years earlier, had defended Paris, and it was drawn mostly from the working class. The role the Guard had played in the defense of Paris had been an immense source of pride for the workers, but it had also led to something much more practical: combat experience. On the morning of the 18th of March, the French army attempted to confiscate the guns of the National Guard in the working-class neighborhood of Montmartre, but were met by guardsmen and workers who refused to let the guns go. Almost immediately, the streets were full of workers and National Guardsmen who drove the government of Adolphe Thiers and his army clear out of Paris. The workers had been not only disgusted with the performance of the army during the war, they had taken it as a personal affront that this army would now try to disarm the only people who had tried, through great personal sacrifice, to do the job the army should have done. With the official government of France expelled from the capital, the workers declared the Paris Commune. Through the implementation of a plethora of policies that would be radical even in our day on policing, food, housing, women's rights, and other issues, they attempted to build the first worker state in history. 2 months later, however, the French army returned, this time with support from the Prussian army. This support had not been difficult to find. All it took was Adolphe Thiers pointing out what an absolutely disastrous precedent it would set if working rabble actually succeeded in overthrowing a, quote, legitimate European government. The combined might of the French and Prussian armies, so recently at war with each other but now united against this class foe, was too much for the Communards to repel. But they definitely did not give up without a fight. Bloody Week lasted from the 21st to the 28th of May, 1871, and it definitely earned the moniker. Estimates of the dead Communards vary, but a generally accepted range is between 10 and 15,000 workers slaughtered in the streets of Paris in a week. Bodies were left to rot, and the streets ran red with blood. For context on how violent this was, during the Reign of Terror of the Great French Revolution, over the course of 10 months, about 16,000 people were killed across the entire country. During the Battle of Gettysburg, the bloodiest battle of the U.S. Civil War, nearly 8,000 were killed in a day. Bloody Week, indeed. Starting with Marx and Engels, continuing through Lenin, and right on down into the present day, it is generally agreed among socialists that the single biggest mistake the Communards made was not doing what was necessary to prevent a counter-revolutionary attack which they should have known was coming. This mistake manifested in two decisions. The first was not to seize the government treasury in Paris, which would have deprived Adolphe Thiers of funds and made those funds available to the Communards. The second manifestation was the failure to pursue the remnants of the French army at the end of March and crush them, which the Communards probably could have done given that the French army was still in tatters after being defeated by the Prussians, and was in total disarray during its panicked flight from Paris to Versailles. The Communards did not decisively defeat the bourgeois government when they had the chance, and so were wiped out in the counter-revolutionary attack. And time. Now, before we move on here, I do want to take a moment to try to tie this historical event from 150 years ago to our present day. It's very easy to view the commune abstractly, or to think that, since it happened so long ago, it has no bearing on our modern world. But that would be a mistake. The entirety of the 20th century is replete with example after example of counter-revolution against movements for national or class liberation. Just a handful of the most famous examples include the treatment of Cuba after 1959, with the over 600 known attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro, the failed Bay of Pigs invasion aimed at overthrowing the new government, and decades-long sanctions that exist to this day, that are illegal under international law, and that are designed specifically to cripple the economy and force the capitulation of the island. The successful overthrows of Salvador Allende in Chile in 1973 and Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso in 1987, resulting in the former's suicide and the latter's gruesome murder. And the utterly brutal campaigns of terror and murder against anyone even suspected of even the flimsiest ties to the communist movement that took place on the Korean Peninsula before, during, and after the fighting of the Korean War. The point I'm making is, the Paris Commune was not a one-off example of tragic cruelty by an overly zealous national leader. It was, instead, the first in a long line of examples of violent attempts by capitalist ruling classes everywhere to crush mercilessly any attempts at challenging their power. And as we will see throughout the entire history of the Soviet Union, the Bolsheviks were not being paranoid when they thought the capitalist world powers, specifically Britain, Germany, and the United States, were trying to undermine their socialist project. Because it's only paranoia if you're wrong. Okay, so that was the Paris Commune of 1871. Next up, we're heading back over to Russia for the celebration-turned-tragedy of the coronation of Tsar Nikolai II. In 1881, as we discussed last time, the Tsar Liberator, Alexander II, was blown to smithereens. His son became Tsar Alexander III, and also as we discussed last time, he presided over a brutal backlash against the revolutionary movement. Well, in 1894, Alexander III, a relatively young and strapping man, very unexpectedly died from kidney failure. That left his son and our friend, Nikolai, as the new Tsar. Nikolai was officially coronated in 1896, and to celebrate his coronation, a big party for the people was set up in Moscow at the Khodinskaya Field in the northwest corner of the city. The tragedy occurred when there was a stampede which resulted from poor planning and crowd management, and left nearly 1,400 dead and another 1,300 injured. Now, to be fair, Nikolai was not directly responsible for the stampede. He'd had nothing to do with the planning and wasn't near the stampede when it happened. But his reaction when learning about it was reportedly cold, almost indifferent. Not at all what the people were hoping for from their new divinely appointed ruler. That was bad enough, but what really upset everyone was when he attended a ball in his honor at the French embassy the same night. Now, again, to be fair, skipping this ball would likely have been an international faux pas, and so, in a sense, the Tsar had to attend. But by attending, and eating, drinking, and dancing with nobility and foreign dignitaries all night while the people of Moscow buried their dead and tended to their wounded, and by failing to have any public reaction at all to the tragedy, he gave the impression to everyone that he was not going to let a simple thing like nearly 3,000 casualties at an event held in his honor in the second most important city in the empire stop him from having his good time. Thus, his reign got off to a rocky start in the public relations department, to say the least. At the time, the Khodinskaya tragedy was only that, a tragedy. That is, it was a single event only. It did not have to come to be viewed as the start of a pattern in Nikolai's behavior. He could have course-corrected and taken steps to regain the favor of the people which he had lost. and the tragedy could have gone down as an unfortunate start to an otherwise successful reign. But, as we'll see for the rest of this episode, this Nikolai did not do. Not even close. If you are enjoying this show, and if you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. As I am just starting out, I do not yet have Patreon-exclusive material. However, if the Patreon page attracts enough attention, that will definitely change. Please also leave a review and rating on whichever podcast platform you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. Now, back to the show. By 1904, the Tsar had a problem on his hands. As capitalism developed further and the problems of the agrarian sector went unaddressed, the number of strikes and unrest across the country were increasing drastically. So Nikolai did what many kings, rulers, and emperors have done throughout history when they are faced with domestic issues they don't really know how to address. He started a war. And he promised everyone the war would be quick, painless, and solve everybody's problems. The country he decided to pick a fight with was Japan. Tensions between the two countries over control and influence of Manchuria and Korea had been simmering for a while anyway. Russia had long sought a warm water port and had finally obtained one when they leased the Liaodong Peninsula from China and built Port Arthur on the Pacific. The Japanese, for their part, were seeking to expand their influence in the region as well, and when negotiations over Korea and Manchuria broke down, in large part due to the disrespectful and racist attitude of the Russian leadership toward the Japanese, the Russo-Japanese War broke out. A blow-by-blow of the conflict is not necessary for us here. What is necessary is to drive home just how much of an unmitigated disaster the war was for Russia. The two most consequential defeats were the siege of Port Arthur and the Battle of Tsushima. During the siege of Port Arthur, the Japanese fleet blockaded the Russians inside the port, while Japanese ground forces, after a lot of fighting, were finally able to capture the hills above the port and sink every ship in the bottled-up Russian Pacific Fleet one by one. The Battle of Tsushima, the final of the war, involved the Russian Baltic Fleet, which, if you look at a map, you might notice is a long way from the Pacific. While the siege of Port Arthur was ongoing, the Russians had dispatched their Baltic Fleet to reinforce the Pacific Fleet. To complete this journey, the Baltic Fleet was forced to sail from the Baltic Sea near Finland, through the North Sea, down the western coast of the European and African continents, around the Cape of Good Hope on the southern tip of Africa, up through the Indian Ocean, and finally through the Yellow Sea into the Straits of Tsushima between Japan and Korea. It was a grueling journey, and a long journey, taking a total of 7 months. When the Baltic Fleet finally arrived to recapture Port Arthur, which had fallen after the fleet had set sail, the Russians engaged in a sea battle that would go down as one of the most glorious in history for Japan. The Japanese caught the Russians by surprise, and over the course of a single 24-hour period, from the 27th to the 28th of May 1905, they sunk or captured the majority of the Baltic Fleet. After the humiliating and total defeat at Tsushima, Russia surrendered. Domestically, the Tsar was already dealing with a full-blown revolution, as we'll see in the next section. Internationally, the defeat was supremely embarrassing, as Japan was at the time seen, through extremely racist eyes, I should say, as backwards and weak, while Russia, a great European power, should have crushed the upstart Japanese easily. In the end, the war upon which Nikolai had relied to bolster his regime's legitimacy and provide a boon to the economy had done the exact opposite. his legitimacy was in deep question. While the two most important Russian naval fleets sat at the bottom of the ocean, and revolution had paralyzed the empire. We now turn to that revolution. The year in which it took place was 1905, and so we creatively call this revolution the Revolution of 1905. The so-called trigger of the revolution is known as Bloody Sunday, but revolutions always have a lot of backstory. And so we might say the trigger to the trigger was a worker strike that started at the end of December 1904. A handful of workers were fired from the Putilov Works, a giant factory in St. Petersburg, and this spurred the workers to respond by declaring a strike. The strike grew as the days passed, and on Sunday, the 9th of January 1905, a large crowd of 200,000 peaceful petitioners, with a priest, Father Georgi Gapon, at their head, marched down Nevsky Prospect to the Winter Palace to petition the Tsar. They'd had enough. The terrible working conditions, the inhumane treatment at the hands of the factory owners, and the constant cold and hunger and disease. The workers believed, and Father Gapon fostered this belief in them, that the Tsar would make everything right if only he knew about their concerns. There had been a long-standing myth in Russia of the Tsar Batyushka, the Little Father Tsar, who cared about his people and wanted to protect them, but was constantly being misled and having his efforts thwarted by self-interested ministers and greedy bureaucrats. So the workers would cut through the middlemen, speak directly with the Tsar, and hopefully have their grievances redressed. But by the end of that fateful day, the workers were disabused of the notion that the Tsar cared about what happened to any of them. Once the procession reached the Winter Palace, soldiers who had been stationed at the palace to meet and control the crowd opened fire into it, wounding, killing, and creating chaos. Death counts range from the hundreds to the thousands, but nobody disputes the effect Bloody Sunday had on Russia. It must be said that Nikolai himself did not give any order to shoot. He was not even at the palace at the time. He was at the royal estate at Tsarskoye Selo, a short train ride outside the city limits. But he had been told ahead of time that there would be a petition and a march. He could have come back to meet them, but he chose not to. Furthermore, he did not publicly express any regret or reprimand or dismiss anyone who was nominally at fault for the massacre. Just like with the Khodinskaya tragedy 9 years earlier, the impression the Tsar gave was that he could not be bothered to be bothered with the deaths of his subjects. And so, the indisputable effect Bloody Sunday had on Russia was to shatter once and for all in the minds of the people the belief in the Little Father Tsar. From here on out, they were convinced the Tsar really did not give a damn what happened to them. News of Bloody Sunday touched off strikes throughout the rest of the year across the empire. Over the summer of 1905, peasants also went into revolt against conditions of not enough work, not enough pay, and not enough food. To make matters worse, the humiliating conclusion to the Russo-Japanese War turned even the armed forces against the Tsar, which meant Nikolai did not have a reliable way to put down the revolts and strikes. The initial demand the Tsar faced was for a Duma, or state council, to be formed. The Duma was to be the body of the people of the empire, and an official organ for them to redress their grievances with the Tsar. But remember last time when I said Nikolai really, really did not want to share power? He stubbornly resisted these demands. Also, remember when I said Nikolai was horribly wishy-washy and indecisive? He finally gave in to the demands in early March. But, still delusional that he could get out of this without actually having to concede anything, he had first tried to compromise by allowing the Duma to have only consultative powers, but no administrative or legislative authority. At this, everyone just threw their hands up in exasperation. That particular ship had sailed so long ago, it might as well have been at the bottom of the Tsushima Straits. His proposal only angered the nobility, who were convinced now more than ever that Nikolai just did not get it. As the revolution dragged on, the liberals in the government urged the Tsar to create a constitutional democracy as the only solution. On the 1st of October 1905, Sergei Witte, he of the rapid industrialization plan a few sections back, presented Nikolai with the October Manifesto, which created a Duma, granted to it legislative duties, and to the people, granted universal suffrage and other basic civil rights. In a move that must have absolutely infuriated Witte, Nikolai hesitated signing the manifesto, as he was loath to end the absolutism of Tsarist Russia. He was afraid of betraying his dynasty and his divine mission on earth as God's representative to the Russian people. But finally, after much pleading, cajoling, and threatening from Witte, Nikolai signed the manifesto on the 17th of October. The unrest continued, however. Workers kept striking into November and December in major cities like Moscow, but with the October Manifesto now in hand, public furor had died down, and the strikes were crushed by police and soldiers. On paper, Russia was now a constitutional monarchy. The manifesto did create the Duma and grant a series of legal and civil rights to the citizens of the empire. However, just as soon as order was restored in the empire, Nikolai backpedaled on the whole thing. He repeatedly used the letter of the October Manifesto to betray the spirit of the document and the revolution by invoking his right to dissolve the Duma whenever they threatened his agenda, and by dismissing ministers he did not like. In total, there would be 4 state Dumas. The first two were too left-leaning for Nikolai's taste, so he dissolved them both and then basically rigged the elections for the third Duma in 1907 to ensure it would be pliable and amenable to his agenda. It turned out to be the only Duma that actually sat a full term, from 1907 to 1912. The fourth Duma was then elected in 1912 to another 5-year term, but would ultimately be left holding the bag with hot potatoes when the music stopped in 1917. Now, what the Tsar did was technically legal according to the new rules of the game as laid out in the October Manifesto of 1905. But his behavior demonstrated to all that he was not serious about reform, or interested in listening to his people. The final years of Russian imperial political history are ones of Nikolai undermining any semblance of democracy that might have arisen in the wake of 1905. As for the socialists, revolutionaries, and specifically the Bolsheviks, the revolution of 1905 was later seen as a dress rehearsal for the October Revolution. While the various socialist parties had been caught flat-footed in January, as the year wore on, they had been able to gain influence over the spontaneous workers' movements across the country. But 1905 is significant for another reason as well. It saw, for the first time, the creation of Soviets. The Russian word Soviet just means council, both in the sense of general advice one gives and in the sense of an advisory body. So going forward, when you hear the name Soviet Union, remember that it technically only means a union of councils. The Petersburg Soviet of Workers' Deputies was the most important of the Soviets of the Revolution of 1905. It was presided over by Trotsky, and will make a major comeback in 1917. But special tip of the hat goes to the first Soviet in Russian history ever, the Ivanovo-Voznesensky Soviet of Authorized Workers, which had its first session in May 1905. Ironically, most socialists, including many Bolsheviks, were skeptical and even hostile towards Soviets as they arose across the empire. But Lenin saw in them the embryo for future revolutionary activity. He understood that they could be vehicles for workers directly running affairs of economy, industry, and state. And so we should probably, definitely, put a pin in that. As we wrap up our survey of Russian history leading up to the revolutions, exploring the social, political, and economic factors that all contributed to the fateful year of 1917, we come now to undeniably the biggest and most direct trigger of all, World War I. In fact, as 1905 and its revolution have now ended, we can just skip right ahead 9 years to the outbreak of that war, because from a revolutionary and socialist perspective, not much happens. Tsar Nikolai jockeys for position against the Duma through various iterations, taking off everyone in the process. The Bolsheviks boycott the Duma altogether, which Lenin later called a mistake, while the Mensheviks and SRs participate. The working class grows while their material conditions fail to improve. And then, in 1914, war breaks out in Europe. A rehashing of the entire war is both too complicated and unnecessary here. Instead, we need only understand the impact of the war on Russian society. The Russian Empire entered World War I on the 26th of July, again, this is old style, 1914, according to treaties it had signed with France and Britain, against Germany and the Austro-Hungarian and Ottoman empires. The national economy did experience a war bump toward the end of 1914 and into 1915, as almost all the belligerent nations did. But within a year of war, the economy started to falter and defeats on the front lines began to mount. With the war going badly, the Tsar took two specific steps designed to improve the situation, but wound up being horrible blunders that exacerbated everything. First, he took direct command of the armed forces in 1916. He thought he was doing the patriotic thing and fulfilling his duty as leader of his people. The problem was, Nikolai was no Napoleon. And so instead of inspiring his people by taking charge, as the defeats continued, now Nikolai's name was attached to them, which further eroded his legitimacy in the eyes of the armed forces, the masses, and the nobility. His second mistake was publicly acknowledging his wife Alexandra's influence and role in the planning and execution of the war. See, Alexandra had converted to Russian Orthodoxy and taken a Russian name and patronymic, Alexandra Fyodorovna, in order to marry Nikolai, whom she did love. But she had, in fact, been born Prince Alex Victoria Helene Louise Beatrix of Hesse, which was a principality in Germany. Yes, in a war with Germany, the Russian Tsar made it known to all that he trusted his German wife's advice and guidance in military affairs. To my knowledge, there is no hard evidence that Alexandra was, in fact, a German agent, or was actually attempting to undermine the Russian war effort. But if Nikolai was no Napoleon, Alexandra was no Joan of Arc. Her advice was often just plain bad, and in her letters to her husband discussing the war, she always seemed more concerned with Nikolai's personal well-being than with any single military success. And besides, in the eyes of the Russian people, the nobility as well as the masses, the mere appearance that a German woman was leading the Russian Tsar astray was enough. As the war dragged on, Alexandra went from being seen as just an out-of-touch and cold tsaritsa, which was bad enough, to a national security risk by the nobility, and a hated symbol of the regime's apathy toward the suffering and fighting and dying of the Russian masses. Speaking of the masses, the wider population quickly grew tired of the war. The peasants were providing the bulk of the soldiers and sailors, but they colloquially called the front lines the meat grinder due to the high casualty rates. The Russian Empire had the highest population of any belligerent in World War I by far, at around 175 million people. But they were just behind Germany for total number of casualties in the armed forces, 1.7 million to Germany's 1.8 million. And they also tied the Ottoman Empire for the highest overall deaths, civilian and military, at an estimated 4 million. And that doesn't even count the number of people who died due to the economic hardships inflicted by the war. Workers were also suffering. Some workers were sent to the front as either enlisted or conscripted men, but most were needed in the factories to keep cranking out the military hardware the army so desperately needed. The owners of the factories, of course, grew filthy rich off of the government contracts. But workers saw their purchasing power evaporate due to a combination of wages being pushed down by employers and, more importantly, rampant inflation. This inflation was spurred on by the army siphoning off so much of the productive capacity of the empire that this led to shortages in the domestic market. By the eve of the February Revolution, inflation was estimated at a whopping 400%. Lenin and the Bolsheviks were very loud and outspoken about what they saw as the imperialist nature of the war. Lenin wrote in his 1916 book, Imperialism as the Highest Stage of Capitalism, about the tendency of capitalist production to lead not to constant variance in production through free competition, but to the accumulation of more and more production under the control of the winners of that competition. That is, the tendency of capitalism toward monopolization. He also extrapolated this tendency to capitalist empires, such as Britain and Germany, and argued that the material driver of the war, the reason there was a war to begin with, was that Germany, having become a unified nation only about 40 years before the outbreak of the war, was late to the Imperial Party. France, the United States, but especially Britain, had already divided up the imperial spoils of Africa, Asia, and Latin America between themselves, and Germany simply did not have access to enough of the raw materials which it needed to continue its industrial and economic growth. It saw the holdings of the other empires, but particularly of the British Empire, as vital for its own continued growth, and the only way Germany could change the status quo and gain those holdings for itself was through war. In other words, the world market was represented by a pie of definite size, and after the initial act of divvying up that pie, the only way for one to gain more pie was taking it from someone else. Thus, tensions on the European continent had been high for years prior to 1914, and anyone bothering to pay attention could see a war was imminent. The assassination of the Austrian Archduke Franz Ferdinand was simply the match that lit the powder keg, while the secret treaties many of us were taught about in high school and college only determined where the battle lines were drawn. But the material basis of the war was capitalist competition between imperialist powers. This is why the imperialist nature of the war will figure so prominently in Lenin's and the Bolsheviks' rhetoric throughout 1917, and why they saw the war as the final death throes of a capitalist mode of production that had outlived its usefulness and threatened to destroy everything. They were not just repeating slogans they had determined would be useful tools of propaganda in a naked power struggle. Lenin's Imperialism as the Highest Stage of Capitalism was a data-driven study of the nature of capitalism in the early 20th century, and the phrase imperialist war was derived from both analysis and lived experience. To them, and it must be said to many historians today with the benefit of hindsight, the imperialist nature of World War I was self-evident. The bourgeoisies of the great European powers, the empires in charge of the world, were determining through the use of force and the expenditure of millions and millions and millions of lives what the new pecking order would be. And the Russian people, the workers, and the peasants were, by 1917, beyond fed up with it. Before we wrap up, we're going to end with the obligatory look at a certain man from Siberia. But, as previously mentioned, this is going to be only the briefest of looks. Even though his life is not connected at all with the Soviet Union, it just does not feel right to talk about the Russian Revolution without him. So I hope you enjoy the following on perhaps the most famous mystic in world history, Grigory Yefimovich Rasputin. Rasputin was born in the village of Pokrovskaya in the district of Tyumen in Siberia on the 21st of January, 1869. He made the acquaintance of the royal family in 1905, and soon captured the attention of the Tsaritsa, Alexandra. Alexandra came to believe that Rasputin could save her and Nikolai's son, Alexei, from his affliction of hemophilia. See, Alexei was heir to the throne, and so should he not survive childhood, hemophilia being a very serious life-threatening disease at the time, the dynasty could be thrown into chaos. But even more than the concern for the future of the empire, both Nikolai and Alexandra truly did love their family and their children deeply. They were sick with worry over the safety of their son, and so were desperate for anything that could help him, which was just about the only humanizing and relatable trait the two of them had. Rasputin recognized this and was able to exploit their love for their child to his own advantage. At times, he really did seem to have a sort of mystical healing power that could temporarily ease Alexei's pain, and eventually, Alexandra came to believe that without Rasputin, Alexei would die. In time, she started turning to him not just to heal her son, but for spiritual guidance in all facets of her and the empire's life. We aren't going to dive into Rasputin's endless controversies and scandals connected with the royal family, except to say that there was endless controversy and scandal brought on the royal family by Rasputin's endlessly controversial and scandalous behavior. Rasputin was a con artist, a drunkard, and a womanizer, and he took every advantage of the wide leeway his direct connection with the Tsar afforded him to settle personal debts, rack up new ones, and basically piss off absolutely everyone in the nobility of St. Petersburg for years. Rasputin was ultimately killed, even though, as I'm sure many of you know, it took a hilarious number of attempts, by a clique of the nobility the night of the 30th of December, 1916. But by then, the damage to the Tsar's reputation among the nobility had been done. Nikolai had turned a blind eye to the alcoholic swindler running amok in his and his wife's name for far too long. And this was yet another factor in convincing the nobility, the people with power surrounding the Tsar at all times, that the Tsar had to go. So there we have it. A necessary social and economic reform, the emancipation of the serfs, that didn't actually succeed in reforming society and the economy enough. The brutal conditions that went along with the industrialization and capitalization of the empire's economy and gave birth to a young and highly adversarial proletarian class. A noble but doomed attempt at building a worker state that demonstrated the need to not underestimate the ruthlessness of the ruling classes when challenged. A series of missteps that displayed Tsar Nikolai's indifference to the suffering of his subjects, his incompetence at solving the problems facing the empire, and horrendous judgment in his personal life. A revolution that only succeeded in proving to everyone that the Tsar would never be an ally, only an obstacle. And finally, a war that heightened all the problems and inadequacies of the Tsarist regime to an unsustainable level. By 1917, the Russian army was facing imminent collapse on the front. The domestic economy was in shambles. Morale across the empire was in the toilet. And the nation was being pushed to the breaking point until it finally broke. If you ask me, it would have taken a miracle to avoid a revolution that year. And next time, we will see that, alas, for Nikolai, there were no miracles to be found. Thank you so much for listening. If you are enjoying this show, and if you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. Any amount helps and is greatly appreciated. This entire project is run only by me in my spare time, and in practicing my anti-capitalist values, I will never run ads. So regular contributions allow me to devote more time, energy, and resources to making the show the best it can be. Please also leave a review and rating on whichever podcast platform you are using. And please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. If you'd like to get in touch, you can write me at sovietpod@gmail.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. До свидания.